Welcome, everybody, to the Chinchilla Pickin' Podcast. It is December the 17th, 2023 at 3:54 p.m. As always, we hope to be entertaining, educational, and uplifting because we want everyone to make money. My name is David Underwood, and I'm joined by the one and only Baron of Bonds, Brandon Beaver. Brandon, how are you?
I just want to state how committed I am to this show and to the listeners. The Cowboys game's coming on about 20 minutes. I will be here doing this show instead of watching it live. You're welcome.
We appreciate your commitment. Hopefully we don't take up too much time of your day, but I appreciate your commitment, Brandon. You are a true gentleman.
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you, man. No matter how many Cowboy cards you buy, it's, you know, whatever.
Hey, PSA. So here's the thing I discovered. I'll be real quick because it's not a sports card show. I know that. But on eBay now, if you've got a seller that, and this could have been around for a long time. I've been out of the hobby for about 15 years until I just got back into it. But if you spend enough on a card and the seller has the authenticity guarantee checkmark, then what they do is they'll take the card. And it has to be graded by PSA or two other companies, CGC or SSG or SGS or whatever. I don't know the other cards. I just use PSA. But if it's graded by them, then eBay they will automatically ship it to a authenticator that works for eBay, and they'll authenticate it, make sure the grading is not fraudulent, and then they'll send it to you. So that's pretty cool.
Nice. That is pretty cool.
Yeah, I did that. Recently did that with a Micah Parsons autograph. Card, a rookie Micah Parsons autograph, which I'm stoked that is now in my living room.
Nice. I don't do eBay, but I do these. I go through auctioneers who are certified, and I buy coins and different things. Like, I've been looking at like Han Dynasty money boxes and scrolls right now. I haven't bought any yet because I have a lot of medieval European coins and so cool. forth. But I'm looking more into that kind of stuff. We'll see.
Awesome. Nice.
Lots of I told my daughter it's yours in the will. This is just my stuff to hold, and I'm not gonna sell it anytime soon. So
yeah, I'm the same way. Sitting to the left of my computer right now is a stack full of collectibles and letters from famous people or people that were related to famous people. I've got a letter that's handwritten and signed by Sarah Roosevelt, who is FDR's mom. That's pretty cool. That's sitting over here to the left-hand side of me. I need to frame all this stuff and get it put away because right now it's just stacked up.
Right. I have an Eastern European 18th century bowl that has a really cool decoration. I throw my keys in it when I come home from work and coins and stuff. That's what I do in my antiques. I need to really take care of them and store them somewhere nice. But what can I say? All right, well, let's talk about stocks and investments. I want to start off the show, and I told you I was going to start off this way, talking about last week. I made some what I think was at that time fair and reasonable predictions about what the Fed was going to do and what their inflation rate was going to come in, and I got it wrong. I mean, I got it wrong. But that's why I also gave the advice, like, don't invest until after the Fed make the decision if you're looking to trade. But if you're looking to invest, I mean, there's never a bad time. You're going to put in for long term. But if you're looking to trade, wait till after the Fed so you know which way the market's moving. I made that statement because, you know, we can always get things wrong. And so I got it wrong on what the inflation was going to come out. It came out in line, unchanged, right? But the Fed, even though it was unchanged, and I thought that if it was unchanged, the Fed would at best just keep rates right where they are. But then Fed Powell came out and became very dovish. He went from hawkish to dovish. He changed. He was not consistent. And he came out and said that he was signaling that he was going to start rate cuts next year, which I personally think is a bad decision. But you know, it's a huge change and shift in his policy and what he's been saying. And I got it wrong. I didn't see that coming. I really believed Powell in what he has said earlier before last week, in that he was going to remain hawkish and concentrate on inflation. So,
well, the Fed Fed watchers and a lot of people in the market were already pricing in 3 rate cuts, which to me seemed like it was going to be not, you know, the least like it, to me, it seemed like it was the least likely possibility. But I guess it's not. They released the Fed, the dot plot at the end of it. That's got the 3 rate cuts. There could actually be more that happen. He hasn't ruled out another rate hike before the end of the year, which is interesting to me as well. He did mention that there's they're not waving the victory flag yet. But to me, this is kind of like Powell shifting from being Paul Volcker to being Alan Greenspan, and he's kind of trying to maestro these interest rates. And I don't know what the end result of that's going to be. It didn't end very well for Alan Greenspan with the housing crash. He wasn't Fed chair when it happened, but in one of his books, he actually apologized for contributing to that. So I don't know where this is going to wind up.
It's crazy to watch and see, and these decisions the Fed is making and Powell is making are just, you know, to me, it just seems illogical. Years ago, 2 years ago, we were criticizing Powell for not doing anything to curb inflation. And then you even came out and said, here's what he's probably going to do. And he did exactly what you said. Yeah. And you said it would end up, you know, badly. It didn't end up as bad as what you were predicting, but it still did not help, right? Inflation went higher.
So here's the thing, and I don't know if this is so much of a coincidence, but Powell was up for renomination a couple years ago when he was putting off the interest rate hikes. And he put them off until after he was renominated. Now, next year, I don't know if this is a coincidence or not, but major election year next year. As he cut rates, right? You know, look good and
got to cut those rates, keep the economy booming so he can look good, right?
Or is he trying to? I don't know. I'm not trying to. The accusation is he trying to keep the Biden administration happy. I don't know.
I don't know either, man. But I don't want to speculate on that. I just want to say I got it wrong. And that's what they were looking to change from hawkish to dovish. I think I missed the rally on that, but we'll see. I have a few more points on that in my 3 articles I have for you, believe it or not. So there's a little teaser.
All right,
so let's get into the rules. Rules, rules, rules. Brandon and I get together 5 to 10 minutes before the show, and we tell each other what we're going to talk about. You're here to lie back and forth, the bidder and the banker. I said that completely wrong this time. Right here live for you. We don't make this up. We actually don't really know what we're talking about half the time, right? So there you go. Brandon, lead us off, man.
All right. So end of the year, every end of the year, Spotify does their Spotify Wrapped thing where they deliver some interesting numbers. I want to talk about them a little bit here. So 70% of our listeners discovered us in the past 12 months. 70%, pretty high number there. We were streamed across 8 countries. We were the top 3 podcast genres preferred by our listeners are business, comedy, and tech. Top 3 music genres preferred by listeners are rap, pop, and contemporary country. The pop thing surprised me. I didn't really expect that we'd have any Taylor Swift listeners listening to this podcast, but I guess we might.
I think my daughter listens and she loves Taylor Swift.
Okay. Followers increased by 30%. Content in minutes up 20%, 21%. Do we go on too long? I wonder. We might be too long.
We tried to stay around 40 minutes. That seems to be our sweet spot. But, I mean, sometimes if the topic deserves it, we go a little longer. Yeah, not a big deal.
75% of our followers listen to just about every episode, returning listeners every week. We have over 1,800,000 minutes of content so far.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, really?
And then let me just, real quick, because we should be proud of this. Here are the countries that people have listened to us so far since the inception of our podcast. I'm going to go pretty quick here because there's a lot. Of course, the United States, Canada, Sweden, United Kingdom, Germany, Switzerland, Portugal, Australia, Hong Kong, Austria, Singapore, India, Denmark, Mexico, Ireland, Belgium, Netherlands, Argentina, UAE, Finland, Hungary, Cyprus, Panama, Taiwan, Bulgaria, Malaysia, New Zealand, Italy, Norway, France, Luxembourg, Philippines, and Poland.
Nice, nice. I like it. I like it a lot.
So either our listeners travel well, and you know every country they go to, they're listening to us, and or we're reaching people out in those countries, which either way, pretty cool.
That is pretty cool, and I like the variety of them. I am still shocked by the 1.8 million minutes. What are we talking about for 1.8 million minutes?
1.8. Well, technically, it's 1,800,000.
Yeah. Man.
What did we talk about?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Hey, well, I'm thankful for anyone who's listening. We appreciate it. We love to hear from you. You love to hear your support. Reach out to us, DM us, Instagram, stock twits, what have you. Find us anywhere. Reach out. Thank you. Hit the subscribe button too, by the way.
So as Dave was talking about, inflation numbers came out over the past week. I want to say this real quick. Last episode we were talking about, and I forgot to mention this in the episode, we were talking about, when we were saying 5% inflation, we were talking about a rolling 12-month average. And we kind of went down the rabbit hole on that without ever saying that's what we were talking about. So listeners might be kind of confused. You have different inflation numbers, the CPI, the PCI, all kinds of different things. Last week, that's what we were talking about, rolling 12-month average. But data
release, how many different acronyms can we fit in here, right?
Right, right. How many different ways can you kind of like skew the same numbers? And really, sometimes it depends on who's talking and what their agenda is. There are so many different... Some people say, like, you know, people lie, but numbers lie even more. I mean, that's honestly, it's true, because people can skew it so much. I mean, there's an old saying that numbers don't lie, but absolutely they do. So, but data released on Tuesday here, and we're talking about the CPI, rose 3.1% year over year, with core CPI increasing 4%, both in line with expectations. The Fed's preferred inflation measure, the PCI, which is the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, rose 3% year over year in October. U.S. unemployment rate fell from 3.9% to 3.7% in November. Private sector employers added an average of 130,000 jobs per month over the past 6 months, down from $228,000 jobs in the previous 6 months, but still signaling the Fed rate cut three times for next year. The inflation seems to be slowing. Economy is stabilizing, supposedly. The FOMC unanimously agreed to keep the federal funds rate in the target range of 5.25% to 5.5%. And to continue reducing the balance sheet. This is the thing that I think actually has more of an impact on inflation. But they're doing a monthly reduction of $95 billion in bond holdings.
Well, I mean, that's going to make a dent in it if they continue with that. And it's much needed, because they were purchasing at a rate of $100 million a month for I don't know how many years in a row did they do that.
Oh, well,
So they got a lot to unravel here, if I could talk right today. $95 billion a month would make a dent. It will, but they have to continue that for years in order to fully get it off.
So rate cuts for next year, but not exactly quantitative easing by any means of the imagination. And I think, you know, I think the Dow wound up 200 points or something like that on that. I think the difference between the Dow being up 200 points and 1,000 points was that point right there. They're still taking $95 billion off the balance sheet in a month, you know, every month. Go ahead.
Is 1,000 points the same as it was during 2008 when the Dow was around 12,000, 13,000 versus 35,000 now? 1,000 points is not the same.
Not at all.
Like when headlines were Dow dropped 700 points, well, that was a bigger percentage drop than it would be nowadays. Nowadays, I'd be like,
For sure. 2018, when we had the first set of rate hikes that came in before COVID, I mean, we were having 1,000-point swings on a pretty regular basis, it seemed like.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The dot plot, they released the dot plot after the meeting, and this outlines their rate path or what they're thinking so far. and that indicated that committee members expected at least three rate cuts in of 25 basis points each in 2024. The Chicago Mercantile Exchange's FedWatch tool, according to them, there's an 88.3% probability that the Fed will significantly ease by the end of next year. So we'll see if that actually happens. But cutting rates by 125 basis points is what they're expecting. Jerome Powell said no one is declaring victory. It's too early. I think that's kind of protecting him in case inflation spikes back up again. But, you know, he doesn't want to be George Bush in front of the Mission Accomplished banner. And
right.
So,
and then we're still there like 20 years later.
Yeah. It's starting to come into our view, he said. Obviously, a topic the whole world is discussing, and it was a topic of discussion at our meeting today, talking about the rate cuts. So, I don't know if this is a good idea. It's really hard to tell. You know, I think we really just try to gauge where the free market would put interest rates at. But I mean, nobody still knows because it's not a free market in this regard.
So you have that, and then you have the worry that it's going to, if you start cutting rates, inflation will spike back up. The thing that they have going for them, Brandon, that we don't, is they have a room full of highly educated people that their only job is to provide them with facts, figures, and, you know, hey, I need, what's the history on this if we do this? And what's this look like here? Versus you and I have to sit here and find all this information ourselves and come up with ideas and thoughts. So we have to... We have to trust that they're not doing something that's very political for their own sake, such as trying to save their job and keep the economy hot so they can keep their job. Hopefully they're doing what's best for the United States economy, which in this case, Powell, in my opinion, has not shown that he's doing that. So I'm worried because of his past. I worry about where he's going with these rate cuts next year. Hopefully, if he holds off till at least the quarter four of next year, then that will give us enough time to not have inflation spike back up.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen, though. If they're going to cut three different times, I don't think it's all going to come at once.
I know. I'm just being hopeful. I'm just being hopeful. Yeah, that's all.
Me too. And hopefully he's not hedging his bets and betting that Biden will win re-election and trying to make the Democratic Party happy right now.
He's meant to be apolitical. That's his job. That's why he doesn't have to answer certain questions in press conferences or in actual Senate hearings. He's allowed to say, I don't want to answer that question because my answer can be deemed political. So he's allowed to not answer questions in an actual judicial hearing because of that. So, that's his job. That's his role. It's to be apolitical and do what's best for the United States.
Yeah, well, they're supposed to be an independent entity, the Federal Reserve. Supposed to be privately held, but as far as independence goes, I think we all know the case is that's not true.
Yeah, there you go.
If you're being nominated by the president, that's not true. I want to get into a little bit of China, though. Let's get into some China news here. I'll give you some statistics. China's middle class is now over 500 million people, and they are back to traveling internationally, but they're not shopping the same as they did before. And this is causing trouble for companies who relied on Chinese tourists. Earlier this year, it was expected by many retailers that we would be seeing a strong uptick in sales due to Chinese travelers hitting the air again, but unforeseen issues have caused many luxury retailers, especially luxury retailers, that count on this customer base to falter. And right now, China has some problems that are pretty unique to China. They're actually trying to fight off deflationary trends. Consumer prices in China fell for the second straight month, deepening a bout of deflation. Consumer prices in China tumbled 0.5% in November, compared with a year earlier. China's National Bureau of Statistics said Saturday that this was steeper than October's 0.2% fall. Exports only rose by 0.5% in November after several months of decline. This is actually adding to deflation because it's causing more of a supplier more of an oversupply of products in China when they're not exporting as much. But surveys pointed to a contraction in activity at factories and services. New home sales continued to drop in October. The data point to a weak close to the year, is what economists are saying. And rather than supply shortages, there's an abundance of overstock in Chinese goods right now in China, and this is causing more deflation to steepen even worse. Now, in my opinion, I think the United States would be smart to use this as a point for negotiations. If you were to lower Chinese tariffs here in the United States, that would help bring down inflation in the United States and would also ease deflation in China. So kind of a quid pro quo there, if you can make that deal.
If you can make that deal, that would be a good deal to make. The problem is right now is the security issues coming out of anything China related. Even the British government recently has come out and banned certain government projects that involve Chinese tech companies. And so there's still those continued worries about the privacy and security of the infrastructure if we're using Chinese products. Now, if we're just talking about average disposable goods that you would sell at Walmart or Target or something, that's a little different. Right. You know, that would have to be more of, you know, just tariffs and price of shipping. But I think the thing that's really hurting China right now, and the thing that's the only headwind to NVIDIA is the problem with shipping technology and chips and things back and forth. And that's hurting China in that regard. So more countries than just the United States are jumping on board. Great Britain joined it this week.
So where the United States companies come in here, and by the way, I agree with what you're saying. I just think that, hey, bring this up in the meetings. I'm sure Biden, I hope they are, at least, hey, you know what? We can help you out. We can lower the tariffs. That will help you out with your deflation problem and the effects of the recession that you're still dealing with, and maybe bend some to us as well, because you need us in this situation actually more than we need you. That's what I would say. That's my opinion. But prior to COVID-19, the most popular way for Chinese tourists to see the area that they were going to visit was bus tours. So we've all seen that. If you've ever been to Paris or New York City or San Francisco, you get on the bus and you go around, see different monuments and stuff. But they would also drop you off at famous local shopping sites like Macy's in New York City, for example, or the old Toys R Us, which is no longer in Times Square. But those are the different places they would drop you off at. There's a huge influx of shoppers because of this at the time when they would do this. It would bring a lot of business to American retailers. But now, post-COVID, the largest demographic of these travelers is under 40. Instead of jumping on these tour buses, they're using apps that tell them where these iconic places are. And they're using the apps to go to these different iconic places and take selfies and such. So instead of taking these tour buses that would drop them off at these retailers where they would spend money, they're not getting these retailers anymore. They're going directly to like the Empire State Building or the Brooklyn Bridge or wherever on their own, without stopping there. So this is actually causing a lot of money to be lost for companies such as LVMH and a few others that I'm about to mention here. But luxury companies such as France's LVMH have been downgraded by analysts, including Barclays. This is softer demand from Chinese consumers that they're citing. In late November, a luxury department store named Harvey Nichols that sells brands such as Oscar de la Renta, 3.1, Philip Lim and Red Valentino, along with beauty lines such as Chanel and some of Estee Lauder's products, has said that they're going to be closing one of its two stores in downtown Hong Kong as a result of this. Estee Lauder, the renowned luxury fragrance and skincare brand, they are now navigating a challenging landscape in China due to these shifts of tourism and travel patterns. So let's look into some of this real quick. Chinese tourists and shopping trends. Estee Lauder is actually saying they've put a lot of cash into duty-free stores in the airports. That's one of their strategies to kind of combat this. I think this is actually a decent strategy. Instead of being in New York City and Hong Kong and such and focusing on those stores, where the consumer's not going anymore. Let's meet them where they have to be and where they're going to be. And that's going to be the airport because everybody has to go through there, right? From the earnings report here, they said that organic net sales declined 11%, primarily driven by expected pressures in the companies that are involved in the Asia travel retail business, as well as incremental headwinds from a slower than expected recovery of overall prestige beauty in mainland China. By the way, Chinese sales and regarding, and I'll get to you in a second, Dave, but regarding not just sales in China, but also regarding the Chinese tourists, down 51% year over year. Go ahead, Dave.
So you're telling me that the sales of Estee Lauder is down 11% because of tourism changes.
Chinese tourism. I did not believe this, actually. Macy's blamed some of their loss of sales a couple of years ago in an earnings conference call on Chinese tourism. And I kind of I shrugged at that a little bit myself. But this is a big, big market. And on average, every Chinese tourist used to spend $2,200 on retail, because if they went to New York City, a lot of them wanted the authentic New York City lifestyle, and that was shopping at the big companies like Macy's and such, and they wanted to shop and buy American. But with the explosion of the Chinese internet, Alibaba, for example, and all of the different ways they can just buy foreign goods online now, it doesn't really seem to matter.
Man, well, I mean,
it's also a headwind,
right? So I know there's a lot of the Chinese represent like 1 point some odd billion people in the world, and that's a lot of people. So I mean, that's a huge base, and you have 500 million middle class. That's a lot of people there as well. So I could see the effect that they could have. They have a larger middle class than we have total population in the United States alone. So yeah, I could see the buying power there, but I did not understand the full effect that they have on these companies here.
So retailers, they would cater almost exclusively in the past to Chinese tourists, luxury shops, wherever they traveled. In Parisian department stores, they hired Mandarin speakers to cater to the Chinese tourists. Hong Kong's mom and pop stores, they had transformed into meet the demands of Chinese tourists. They offered products like milk and powder and medicines to Chinese tourists. But recent changes, not even just in the United States, but also in Hong Kong, have made these retailers change their strategies in the past 12 months, because we were just talking in January, not us in particular, but people were just talking in January about how incredible the uptick in sales was going to be for retailers because of Chinese consumers this year coming out of COVID. But it turns out they're not shopping.
Now, are they not shopping because of the whole real estate bubble that popped this year in China and caused a lot of income and net asset worth to fall off?
I think that's part of it. I think it's definitely part of it. A lot of income lost there, deflation in China with a recession and stuff, and dealing with those challenges. But I also think it's the internet headwind. I think it's Alibaba. I watched an interview with a Chinese tourist where she said, "Why would I care about shopping at Macy's in New York City when I can buy anything I want at home now?"
That's true. Yep.
So
definitely true.
The decline in Chinese tourist shopping habits is prompting Estee Lauder in particular to reevaluate its approach. Operating margins. Here's what I thought was interesting. You could see what the what seems like it might be a small decline in gross margin can do to your actual earnings. So last year, Estee Lauder's gross margin was 76%, dropped 6% year over year, which is a pretty decent size drop to 70%, right? But that led operating margins to fall off a cliff. So they dropped from 20% to 7% just in the past year and a half.
Wow, that's a huge drop off, man.
Yeah.
So if your margins are going down that much, and then you're losing 11% of total sales on top of it, your profits just got to be Like, whew.
Yeah.
I would love that. I mean, I don't cover Estee Lauder. It's not a company I trade or have traded. Health and beauty is, I don't really dabble in that sector a lot. I would love to see what their earnings have been now this year versus years past.
Yeah, me too. But Estee Lauder's management, they adopted what they call a smart plan, but they just were very general about it. They didn't go into depth so much, but said they're going to focus on their best markets for now. They're going to prioritize profitability, which everybody says that. They aim to weather the current challenges and position themselves for future growth. So general here. But they said the Chinese market remains crucial. But they're going to strategically adjust their approach to adapt to changing dynamics. This did catch a lot of people off guard. But you know what? It's something that kind of happens in business, and you have to diversify yourself so that this doesn't really kill you the way that it has killed Estee Lauder's earnings.
Yeah, I mean it's catching me off guard. I didn't know this was a huge issue like it was. Very interesting, very cool insight here. But man, yeah, and just a side note, the only companies that are not prioritizing profitability are nonprofits.
Yeah.
So those are the
Yeah.
only companies around that are not prioritizing profitability. If you're a profitable, if you're a for-profit company, you're prioritizing
You better be.
profitability. Right? Or I'm not investing in you.
Right. I don't, I just I thought that was interesting to see. I had a couple, like I said, a couple of years ago, I listened to a Macy's earnings cast, and I was like, they're really blaming their decline in earnings on Chinese shoppers, but it turns out it's a very, very, very big market. And Chinese travelers in the past had spent more as a demographic than any other demographic of travelers in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I can see it, there's more of them, so I can see that. So,
But even on average, the $2,200 per person, that was higher than anybody else from any other demographic.
Really? Okay. All right. Fair enough. Fair enough.
All right.
Cool.
Cool.
What do you got next?
That's what I got. That's everything.
Perfect. Perfect opportunity for me to take over here because I got three good articles for you. Let's start off with this one. Wall Street's so here's the headline. This is on Bazinga at 4:31 p.m. on Friday. So this was the end of day Friday. This is the headline. It says Wall Street's rally brought $5 trillion in wealth to United States household just in time for Christmas. So you're saying Wall Street has that's a big number, 5 trillion. Where are we getting that number from? Well, let's break down the number. Data from the Federal Reserve shows that at the end of the third quarter of 2023, the combined net worth of households and nonprofits in the United States reached $151 trillion. Within the overall wealth portfolio, the value of corporate equities, both directly and indirectly held by U.S. households, amounted to $43 trillion. Assuming the S&P's 500 10%, 10.2% increase in the fourth quarter as proxy for broader equity market gains, this translated to a potential increase of $4.39 trillion in the value of household earnings, equity earnings. So they go on to say it's important to note that the overall wealth increase could be even higher when accounting for the share of bonds, alternative assets held by U.S. households, notably treasury bonds represented by the Invesco Equity Weight 0 to 30-year Treasury ETF saw a strong 7.8% surge in the fourth quarter. So everybody got a big jump in their portfolio and the assets they hold on file. This generally affects the top 10% a lot more than the rest of the country, but usually the middle class will also get a nice bump in their 401ks and holdings as well. Due to this. Thoughts, Brandon?
What excuse does RH have now? I'm telling you, like, I like the company, don't get me wrong, but if the top 10% of earners are getting more spending power, then why is RH declining? I mean, that's their customer base. The top 10%. And if they're, they want to say it's because of a slowdown in spending, but I feel like because of what you just told me, that's not right.
But
Camping.
this is all just the quarter four this year. So that's the increase in their portfolios in the last quarter that we're still in. So they could not be just not spending that money right now.
I mean, that's true, but I would expect that uptick in spending to happen
Well, maybe we'll
at some
see it
point.
when they report earnings next quarter. You know, maybe, you know, I don't know. See, a lot of people hear these numbers and they say, well, that's just the rich. I didn't see any increase in anything. And again, you know, they have a point to a point. It's not just the rich. There are middle households. There are people who have pension plans. Those pension plans just got a little bit stronger. If you have 401k, it moved up a little bit more. You know, there's other ways that everyday individuals are growing their portfolios as well. So it's reaching a broad area. But I think it's good for the overall economy. It brings more equity into the markets, which can be used to open up more companies, to build more infrastructure, and so on and so forth.
Provides job
So,
security, creates more jobs, all that stuff.
yeah, and but here's my question, Brandon, for you particularly. Are people going to go ahead and take these gains they've had in quarter four, this last week of the year, in order to get the taxes, in order to have the taxes settle and be done with it, and then jump back in and be hit with that wash tax come next year? But are they going to go ahead and sell off the Santa Claus rally in the
You know
last
what?
week?
I mean, I was listening. My base case just last week was that that was going to happen. But I don't know. If you're staring at three Fed rate cuts for next year, it usually bodes well for tech. So I don't know.
You
I
think
guess we'll
people just
find
sit
out.
in it?
They might.
Okay. I
I
plan
think
to
it's.
sit in all my holdings right now.
Yeah, me too. But it's. I think there's a better chance of people sitting in it now than there was a week ago.
Right. And I tell you what, man, this quarter four has been really good for me. My Tesla went to 259. I'm very, very much in the positive there. Very happy with those gains right now. Sitting nicely, sitting well. So I'm very happy with Q4. I'm going to be holding on to my investments. I'm not going to be selling, and I still have a little bit of cash on hand from my Intel sale. So I have some money to play around with come January, after I believe we're going to see some sell off in certain areas, and I'm going to be looking for opportunities to get in.
Yeah, you know what? This has been an incredible year. And
Right.
for me at least, in comparison, the S&P 500's done okay, but I mean, I thought we'd be negative on the year.
Right. Yeah. So there you go. All right. Let's move into the next one. And this one is one of your favorite companies, but they made a headline. This was a Reuters headline, came out on 12/16 yesterday at 10:26 a.m. And it's a very short article. I could read the whole thing here real quick. But the headline reads, Robinhood woos wealthier clients from bigger brokerages, aka from the Wall Street Journal. Actually, so Reuters is quoting the Wall Street Journal here. There's only two lines here, so I'll read it real quick. Robinhood Markets or Hood is attracting customers from other brokerages and is seeking to expand beyond its base of young first-time investors, the Wall Street Journal reported on Saturday. Through Wednesday, the trading app received about $1.1 billion in account transfers since October 23rd, when it began offering a 1% match on transferred brokerage accounts. This is all via the Wall Street Journal. Your first initial thoughts, Brandon?
You know what? They've done a lot of pretty good things in the past year, actually. And it's not just that 1% match, but a lot of people that are running their own companies and running their own small businesses that are doing well for themselves, they don't have a 401k that has a company match because it's their company and they may not provide the 401k. Where are you going to put your money? Robinhood's got a 3% match
Right.
on
Yeah.
a
I mean, so
401k.
it's they're again, this is what we've always said is positive about Robinhood, is they're very innovative and they're changing the markets and they're forcing these other financial firms to either change, or Robinhood's going to take their base from them. And so because of Robinhood, we've seen $0 trading fees across the board for stocks at all companies. We've seen what people pay for money market accounts go up as high as 5% at one point across the board because of Robinhood. Robinhood has continued to innovate and change the markets because instead of taking that money and being what they called, this is their words, not mine, greedy as a bank, they were just paying it back to the consumer. And so but the problem with all this is that that cuts into Robinhood's bottom line.
But it's also a part of transferring out of, I mean, just a couple of the years ago where they were making, you know, almost all of their money off the Dogecoin trades and the cryptocurrency day trades and speculation that a lot of rookie day traders and investors were partaking in. And, you know, what we expected last year was not a very good year in the market. This year was an okay year in the market. If there would have been a recession this year and the market would have been even tougher and Robinhood hadn't been working on making that transition to a more sustainable client base and a more sustainable way of trading and investing, then Robinhood would be in trouble right now. I do think partially, though, that they got lucky that we didn't go into a mild or even steep recession this year, because they would have been in trouble and it would have been much more difficult for them to make this transition. But they're taking advantage of the fact that we didn't go into a recession this year, and they're making that change in their business model. And I have to applaud them for it. It's working out faster than I expected it to. You're muted. Can't hear you.
So it's working out well for them. Their average account balance has actually grown, even though their number of accounts has not grown. I'm pulling a rookie move there on, you know, hey, Dave, you're muted. I do meetings all the time. I should know better. But, you know, it is what it is.
It happens.
Right. So let's go on to my last article. And this has to do with a company that I'm actually invested in. And it seems, and this is, I've complained about this constantly to Brandon, to you and I in personal text messages, that every single time I open a position in the company, it seems to go down a little bit. You know, and usually not a whole lot. Tesla's always the exception. It goes down a whole lot, but then it always comes back up for me and I end up making money. But this is another one that I got in a position and it went down a little bit. Well, this article is giving me hope that I made the right decision here. So this one is on CNBC. It was written by Anika Kim Costantino, published today at 8 a.m. And it reads, "The weight loss drug boom isn't over yet. Here's what to expect in the year ahead." Right? So let's talk about Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk, one of my two companies. Novo Nordisk, I believe, is a strong company. I have a position in them. I'm invested in them not long term ever, but I see large growth over the next few years in Novo Nordisk. So I, you know, 2 to 3 year hold here, and then I might exit after I see some big gains. But this goes in here to say, demand for drugs is unlikely to slow in 2024, especially as treatments gradually become more accessible. Much of Wall Street believes the weight loss drug market will only expand. A lot of analysts are saying it's going to be worth $100 billion by the end of the 2020s or the end of the decade. Goldman Sachs, all their analysts are expecting 15 million U.S. adults to be on obesity medications by 2030. And that's not, you know, that's just obesity medications and not just like how it's being used for other issues, diabetes or cardiovascular issues, or all the studies that came out saying that it's good for this and good for that, you know what I mean? Or fatty liver disease. So there's others besides just obesity on this. But it goes in and it says, next year, investors will be watching how the dominant players in the market, Novo Nordisk, Eli Lilly, will navigate the supply issues, because this is the only thing holding them back. They can't make enough, right? Everybody expects the supply constraints to improve, especially since Novo Nordisk has announced they're building this huge new plant ahead to go ahead and pump out more of these so that they can. Novo Nordisk is also expected to win approvals for the expanded use of Wegovy in the United States and Europe. Again, Wegovy and Ozempic are the same drug. It's called different things. I got this wrong last time, and I apologize to anybody who listens to me. I'm going to eventually get this right. Hopefully, They're going to expand to use, and that's based off the drug trials I talked about last time I talked about them. And so there's going to be more medically used that you can have insurance pay for this rather than pay out of your pocket, right? But this means other companies are wanting to take advantage of this. So a new drug from Pfizer and Amgen and the potential for more buyouts or collaborations with larger companies and smaller makers of obesity drugs could alter the market's competitive landscape in the coming months. I don't agree with this author here. Pfizer and Amgen have not had success, especially Pfizer has not had success with their weight loss drug at all. They've had to bring it back a stage in order to revamp it and rework it. As Brandon covered, they went down from 2 pills a day to 1 pill a day, seeing if that, and then they have to redo the whole study and see if that has a better effect. So it's the supply constraints is the only thing holding them back. Supply could increase significantly years from now. Novo Nordisk in November said it was going to invest $6 billion to expand its manufacturing facilities in Denmark. We already covered that here on the show. It's going to finish that construction in 2025. The company also said it's going to spend around $2.3 billion to expand another production site in France. So multiple expansions of these. I can keep going on, but Brandon, thoughts?
I think the Pfizer and Amgen thing, I think that's a collaboration, but I could be wrong.
I mean, you're the Pfizer analyst of Chinchilla Pickin. You're Chinchilla Pickin's Pfizer analyst. Come on now.
I should know this, but I think if I remember correct, I think that's a collaboration for the drug, but yeah.
So what do you think? Is 2024 going to be a huge year for these companies, or do we have to wait and see until the manufacturing plants come online?
I think it's going to be a huge year for the market cap of the companies that, you know, take the lead on this, which Novo Nordisk is already doing.
Right. That's why I'm invested in them and I believe in them.
We'll see if it's a big distraction or if it actually pays off. So far, it seems to be paying off.
All right, cool. That's all you got then, huh? Nothing on the Pfizer drug? Nothing on the Pfizer drug? Are you still invested in Pfizer? Do you still own Pfizer?
I do.
All right, so do you think this is going to help Pfizer out?
What was it, another 10% drop on it just last week? I don't think this is going to help Pfizer out so much now. I mean, the fact of the matter is they're having to go back and spend more on R&D and go back in the into the trials, and that's just not a good thing. That's going to cut into the gross margin and the net margin of whatever weight loss drug they do put out to the market. So I don't know if that's going to help out. You know, I'm more into Pfizer because of oncology, not the weight loss thing. I didn't expect weight loss to be a good thing for Pfizer when I first bought into it. It wasn't even on my radar. So,
but I mean, it could bring in sales that are comparable to what they had with the COVID vaccine.
Well, let's hope it does.
And that's what Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly are seeing, is this huge jump. And when Pfizer, here's my comparison. When Pfizer had the COVID vaccine, they doubled in stock price. This is my thing. Like, Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly had a big run-up already, especially Novo Nordisk this year because of the weight loss drugs. However, I don't think the run-up's done. I think there has more this has more legs underneath it, and it's going to continue running up. And I see a possible doubling by 2025 of the stock price. That's why I invested in it.
Yeah, it's probably, I mean, I think that, you know, 3 rate cuts next year is going to lead to more speculation, so it'll probably put it overvalued.
Right, there you go.
At least for Novo Nordisk. I don't know about Pfizer. Pfizer's that dog with fleas right now, so we'll see.
Right on. Final thoughts, Brandon. Take it away.
You have 3 rate cuts coming up next year. Looks great for the market, but let's see what it does to inflation.
Nice. I did mention this already, but Tesla is no longer one of my dogs. It is winning for me, and I love to see it winning. I think it's going to continue moving on unless the broader market has a downturn in January. I am still skeptical on the Bitcoin mining companies. Again, because of the halving event, you're going to see some of them disappear, and you're going to see some continue on. But how do you know which one's which? There's just too little information to know which one is which for me to offer an investment advice. It's going to be a big event when it happens. You're going to see a lot of the mining companies disappear, and that's going to consolidate the power to a few. Who they will be, I don't know. We have to wait and see. I do feel I want to say I don't have any fundamental reason for it, but I feel like Riot's going to survive. But we have to wait and see. The halving event's going to be huge. That's still something I want to see. Will Bitcoin hit 60,000 again before the halving event is the big question. I see in a lot of these chat rooms that I'm involved in and all these other articles I'm reading. And a lot of people believe that it will. So we'll see if that's a run-up that does happen. If that does happen, it could be to the moon on Bitcoin if that happens before the halving events. We'll see. All right, guys. We appreciate everyone listening. As always, we hope we've been entertaining, educational, and uplifting because we want everyone to make money. Have a good night.
Have a good night.